Welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark Abel. Gentlemen.
Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
Doing great.
Good. Enjoying the fall weather, I hope.
What fall weather? Still pretty warm, but getting ready for football season here. The Bulldogs are ranked in the top 25, depending on which poll you look. So all is good in Athens.
Okay. Well, there must be fall weather in Michigan where you were this summer. Somewhere there's fall weather right now.
We'll get up there and get our fix of color.
Yep. 10% of Medicare's budget is spent on heart failure. That's it's an amazing amount, both on inpatient and outpatient care. Heart failure, as we know, can be difficult to diagnose because the signs and symptoms are often difficult to elicit, and they're also found in lots of other conditions. So we suspect chronic heart failure if the person has typical symptoms and signs of heart failure and risk factors in their medical or social history. The symptoms are obviously breathlessness and fatigue and fluid retention, often seen as ankle swelling and abdominal swelling. The signs we're familiar with, all of us, the laterally displaced apex heartbeat, raised JVP, enlarged liver, third or fourth heart sound, tachycardia, crackles, dependent edema, and the like. So along came a drug called nusiratide, Natricor. It's a recombinant form of 32 amino acid beta-type natriuretic peptide. It's normally produced by the ventricular myocardium. In theory, nusiratide works to facilitate cardiovascular fluid homeostasis through the counter-regulation of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. This, in turn, leads to smooth muscle cell relaxation. Nusiratide was believed initially to be beneficial for acute decompensated CHF, but, well, things have changed, and Mark's going to tell us about that. We're looking this week at a New England Journal of Medicine article. It asks the clinical question, does nusiratide improve outcomes in patients hospitalized with acute heart failure? Mark?
Yeah, that was an amazing statistic, the 10%. I had no idea. I knew it was big, but I didn't know it was 10% of Medicare's budget. That's amazing. And, you know, that's why they're targeting it for rehospitalization rates and trying to reduce rehospitalization rates because those are so high with heart failure. And so this drug was approved, as you said, in 2001. It's BNP, so it's kind of like giving creatine kinase to someone with a heart attack, I guess, because BNP is what we measure to see if someone's in heart failure. And as you said, giving it back to them, in theory, does some things that relax smooth muscle. So there have been a number of small randomized trials that were done to get the drug approved, no really big trials. And meta-analyses of these small trials have actually shown an association between Natricor and renal toxicity and death. That was a study published in JAMA back in 2005. Now, this is the biggest study to date, and they had over 7,000 patients who were hospitalized for acute heart failure, and they got either Natricor or placebo, plus all the usual therapy and things we do for heart failure. They began with an optional bolus of 2 mics per kilo of the Natricor, and then they got an IV drip for up to 7 days. The groups were similar at baseline. They did the analysis by intention to treat, and they basically, so that meant they included everybody who got any amount of the study drug in the final results, which is all good. It was a well-designed study. One of the key endpoints was self-reported dyspnea 6 hours and 24 hours after the beginning of treatment. There was a small improvement with the nusiratide, but it wasn't statistically significant. And I tell you, if it's not significant with 7,000 patients, you ain't never going to get it statistically significant.
Right.
More importantly, I think they didn't find any significant difference between nusiratide and placebo for their combined endpoint, which was death or rehospitalization. Given a choice, I take rehospitalization every time, but, you know, they combined those two, lumped them together. You know, we've been critical of those combined outcomes because that tends to increase the likelihood of finding a benefit. In this case, they didn't. Okay, there was no difference between the nusiratide and placebo. Now, on the bright side for nusiratide, previous studies showed this renal toxicity. This study didn't, but it did show an increase in significant hypotension with a number needed to treat of about 9, or number needed to harm of about 9. So the best thing we can say is it doesn't kill off your kidneys, and it might make you breathe a little better 6 and 24 hours later, but probably not, and it doesn't help you live longer, and it doesn't prevent you from getting back in the hospital.
Wow.
So we can save Medicare billions and billions of dollars by not prescribing this drug.
That's a huge point, and it is an enormous intervention that will make an enormous difference economically, and you know the study suggests it won't have any negative effect on patients. So just going back, I mean, are there lessons that we learned? How did this get to be so widely used, and why didn't we know this ahead of time? Did we fail by not requiring a study that included 7,000 patients?
Yeah, you know, I should have gone back to look at the 12, 13-year-old studies that it was just approved by, but I'm lazy, I didn't. But I suspect it was approved based on some disease-oriented endpoints. They were probably looking at effects on, you know, contractility, effects on smooth muscle, effects on ejection fraction. They might have been looking in fairly highly or more highly selected populations that weren't as typical, perhaps, as the 7,000 patients that they had in the current study. They may not have followed them for very long, and they probably didn't power the studies to look at death or rehospitalization. So they might have, you know, shown a couple studies with symptomatic improvement, maybe not. You know, I'm just in the process of doing a systematic review of some questions related to influenza. Only 3 of the 10 or 11 studies that have ever been done for Tamiflu have ever been published. The other 8 have not. And so I've gotten a lot of that data. I've gotten access to a lot of that data. But, you know, the typical physician reading the journals wouldn't have any idea. So there may also be unpublished research that we don't know about.
It's 2011 now. They've had a decade of an enormous run on this drug.
Yep, absolutely.
We will talk about another depressing study next week. No, this is very interesting, and it raises lots of policy issues. I don't expect that we would be able to answer them, but these are the kinds of things that I hope someone at the FDA and in Congress is thinking about. How do we?
Well, you know, as long as they keep approving drugs based on, you know, cholesterol drugs based on improving cholesterol, and all they require is that it lowers cholesterol more than placebo. You know, that's all it takes to get a cholesterol drug, for example, approved, is showing that it's reasonably safe and that it lowers cholesterol more than placebo, period. That's right. All. They don't have to show it's better than any other drug. They don't have to show it's safer than any other drug. They don't have to show it's improves patient-oriented outcomes.
Right.
And there is huge resistance. And, you know, the FDA gets its bills paid for by industry, a lot of them, because they have user fees. And so the industry is at the table, you know, to some extent, probably writing these rules.
Right. Mark, we'll talk with you again next week.
All right.
Thanks.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem.